Welcome to the Blessings Podcast, where we explore the twists and turns of life in all its perfect imperfection, so you can see how all kinds of other people are just like you. I am Mitzi Campbell, your life story mentor, a transformational teacher, lifelong educator, college professor, with decades of work in education, self-development, and psychology, nonprofit leadership, and the arts. I am a flower photographer, a yogi, a knitter, a voracious reader, and a mom of three fantastic grown-ups. And I'm so happy to be your host for this experience of connection, gratitude, blessings, and lessons. We are here to see firsthand that people of all walks of life go through things that are invisible on the outside, and that we just never know what our fellow humans are carrying with them on this crazy journey. So get comfy and let's listen with love, compassion, and an open mind as we ditch the small talk and go deep into discovering others so we can better get to know ourselves. Welcome back to the Blessings Podcast, everyone. Today I have with me Drew Manning. Drew is fit. He just came off running a marathon in Hawaii like it was a walk in the park. His favorite job is being a girl dad. He has a multi-million dollar fitness and nutrition empire, but best of all, he's an expert in cultivating empathy. As a trainer, he knows the importance of truly understanding what his clients are going through. And he's famous for his fit to fat to fit challenge, where he intentionally gained and lost 75 pounds in 1 year to show his clients and the world how much he cares about their experiences with food, fitness, willpower, and the struggles to lose weight and develop healthy eating habits. He grew up in a strict Mormon household and learned discipline from the get-go. Through a series of highs and lows, serious highs and lows, Drew found out about the profound importance of owning your story. Now, his support for his clients goes well beyond fitness into mindset, and he teaches millions to use the hallmarks of growth mindset, hard work, and compassion for themselves and others to reach their goals inside and outside of the gym. Welcome, Drew Manning.
Wow, Mitzi, thank you so much. Can I actually use that as my official bio now? That was the best written introduction I've ever had. So thank you for that. That was really good.
Oh, you're welcome. I will send it to you. I was a writing professor in another life.
Oh, that was great. Thank you for having me.
Oh, you're so welcome. All right. So we're going to get into your life story, but I'd like to start with something a little deep. What is the kindest thing that anyone has ever done for you?
Oh, that's a really hard question. There's so many things that pop up in my mind. I'm trying to think of one just off the top of my head. Okay. For some reason, this is one's popping up and it has to do with an ex-girlfriend. And hopefully it's not too over the top. Okay. So basically it's a short story in a nutshell. In Utah, I had a dog. I was a new dog owner. I got a dog for my daughters. And I was new to being a dog owner. I accidentally fed my dog some ground beef, thinking like, oh, dogs eat meat. So I gave him some ground beef. He was a puppy. I go run errands. I come back home. He's in his kennel and there's diarrhea everywhere. So I just started dating this girl and she's a dog person. And I didn't know who else to call. And because I didn't know what to do. I'm like, how do I clean this up? I didn't even know what to do. I was like overwhelmed and I had my daughters and all these things going on. And I called her. I'm like, hey, here's the situation. I don't know what to do. Can you come help me? She said, hey, don't worry. I'll be there in 10 minutes. I got you. Boom. She comes in. She shows up. She said, you go take care of the girls. I'll take care of Huckleberry. That was his name. She like cleans up the whole thing, gives him a bath. We throw away the kennel. I didn't even try and clean it. And it was a really kind gesture. I'm like, man, that was and we didn't know each other that well at the time. That act of service meant a lot to me at that time. And it was like, wow, that was really nice of someone to do that for me in a situation that was high stress and overwhelmed for me because I didn't know how to handle it. There you go.
All right. That's a great story. Absolutely great. Yes. That's wonderful. And I always say the first thing that pops up is the thing that's supposed to pop up. So that's why we welcome those.
Okay. Okay, cool. Yeah. That was one of the nicest things anyone's done for me, but I'm sure there's other ones too.
There probably are, but that definitely, that takes the cake, I would say. That's good. Oh my God. Yeah. So, all right. So tell us, where were you born?
I was born in California and lived there till I was about 13.
Okay. And so let's go back and talk a little bit about what life looked like there in California. What was your family like when you were young? What did it look like?
Yeah. So I was baby number 7 out of 11 babies that my mom gave birth to. We same mom and dad, no twins, no adoptions, just 11 kids. I was number 7. So all I knew growing up was I had a lot of siblings and always had to share a room. And I grew up playing sports. So football and wrestling, I saw my older brothers play those sports. So I followed suit and did what they did and it thrived and excelled at those sports, did really well. You mentioned me growing up in the Mormon religion. I no longer practice that religion, but my family does. So I still respect that religion and all religions, but it just isn't for me anymore. I left about 9 years ago or 10 years ago. But yeah, I grew up with a very kind of strict mentality, you know, your typical environment of, hey, don't cry, don't show your emotions, just do what you're told to do. Don't rock the boat, just like fall in line, because I'm sure my parents were in survival mode all the time, trying to just feed 11 kids. So I think there was definitely some disadvantages when it came to emotional well-being, because you can only give so much to each kid. And so anyways, yeah, there was definitely some hard love type of mentality that it was my perception of my environment growing up, whether it was religion or playing those sports, a lot of discipline, a lot of black and white mentality, not a lot of emotions being showed. We just learned how to suppress them and push them away. And so that was the environment that I grew up in. We always had food on the table. My parents did their best to raise all 11 of us, and they did a freaking good job, to be honest with you. I have 2 kids and I can't imagine what it'd be like with 11. That was a little bit of the environment that I grew up in.
Wow. Did you find that your caretakers were your siblings at times?
Yeah, sometimes my older siblings had to step in and babysit a lot. My mom, like, we only had 1 vehicle growing up. And so my dad would ride his bike to work and my mom would have to drop off all the kids at school and practices and piano lessons and football and wrestling and all the, I don't know how they did it. But yeah, sometimes we had to take care of ourselves or the older siblings would be in charge while my parents were gone. But yeah, that's because I was baby number 7. Of course, my older siblings stepped in and had to help out with the younger kids sometimes.
Mm-hmm. How much older is your oldest sibling?
He's, honestly, I'm 42, almost 43. He's 55. So he's about 12 years older. About every 2 years, my parents had a new kid. So it was like clockwork. 3 years, okay. New baby, 2 years, baby.
Oh my gosh. All right. There's a lot of fun in that though. Was there any stories from when you were young that you could really think of as a positive moment, a time when your family had a lot of fun or something like that?
That's a really good question. Yeah. Speaking of that, like around Christmas time, my mom did a really good job of making Christmas special for us. Now, we didn't have a lot of money to give each other a lot of presents, but I remember as a kid, I would want a lot of presents under the tree. So me and my siblings would just wrap up old toys and give them to each other just so we had gifts to give each other. And that was fun. But also my mom, like we had Christmas traditions where on Christmas Eve, we would all make Christmas cookies. Then when we go doorbell ditch our friends and deliver the Christmas cookies to our friends. And it was just like a fun thing, Christmas tradition that we would do where we would doorbell ditch our friends and leave them a plate of cookies on Christmas Eve. So that kind of stuff was really fun. Playing sports, like my dad, even though he was busy, would always show up to all my sporting events and all my siblings' sporting events, which was really cool. Kind of showed a lot of how much he cared about us playing sports. So that was really cool. And other than that, like I said, I didn't know any different. Yes, there were some fun parts, but there were some times where, yeah, I wish I had more space or more alone time. But when you're a kid, you don't know any different. So I liked having all the siblings because we always had someone to play with or something to do. Yeah, we would fight a lot, but what siblings don't, right?
Yeah. What about school? What kind of a student were you?
I was actually really good student. Like I excelled at school as a kid. I enjoyed doing homework. I liked getting A's as much as I could. Like I would say it wasn't until my senior year that I like really slacked off and thought school wasn't cool. I was like, oh, I'm too cool for school. So I like excelled at sports, but I let my grades slide my senior year just because I stopped caring about it. But for the most part, growing up, I did really well in school. And my senior year was like a big dip in performance when it comes to academics. I think I got, just to be totally transparent, I think I got an 890 on my SAT score, which is horrible. But it's just one of those things where I was probably out partying the night before and I just didn't care about those things at that time. And I wish I did. I probably could have gotten into a better school, but I went on to college and played football and wrestling and graduated with my bachelor's degree. And you grow up eventually and become wiser and took schooling more seriously at some point.
What did you want to be when you were growing up?
That's a really good question. Originally, I would have loved to play in the NFL. Never got the opportunity to. But I think I didn't know what I wanted to be. I didn't know what special skills I had. So I just was like a leaf blowing in the wind. I thought engineering was cool. So I started out in college like, okay, let me get an engineering degree. Didn't like that too much. And so I switched to business management and then ended up in finance, to be honest with you. And just because an opportunity arose from that and I got selected, I was the one student from my entire school that got selected to get a job before I even graduated. They offered me a job before I even graduated. And I had a secure salary, good salary position working for Chrysler as a financial analyst. And at the time, they were owned by Daimler, which is Mercedes-Benz. And this is like 2006, 2007. And I was married at the time. And me and my wife, we moved to Illinois and had my first job before I even graduated. So that was a really cool experience. But yeah, I always enjoyed health and fitness. Even though I went to finance, eventually, a couple years into it, I started doing personal training on the side just because 2008 happened and the economy crashed, especially the auto industry. And so I got bought out from my position. We moved to Utah and that's where I started doing personal training. And I'm just connecting the dots for you. So that's where Fit to Fat eventually came from, was me being a part-time personal trainer.
Interesting. So you said that you got your first job before you graduated and you were married. So when did you get married?
I got married in 2005 and it was about a year before I finished college. My wife at the time, we met in Huntington Beach, California. I was out there for the summer. It's like a summer fling, summer love. And I ended up skipping school in the fall semester. I was supposed to go play football in Virginia. And I decided to date her even more. And we got engaged at the end of that semester. And then in spring, that's when I went back to school and played spring ball at that college. And then that summer, we got married. She moved out to Virginia from the West Coast to the East Coast, a little small town in Virginia, middle of nowhere. And she supported me while she worked while I went to school and finished up my last year of college. And played football and then got the job. We moved to Illinois.
Oh, wow. So looking back at that time, were there any things that stand out to you that you miss about your early life?
That's a good question. There's definitely certain aspects. I will say this, before like being married and not having kids and having a good income was like a fun time of life where we didn't have a lot of responsibility. We could be spontaneous. We could do what we wanted. We both were making good income. We had a house, like we bought a nice house. We customized the whole house. We decorated the way we wanted to. Like it was a lot of fun being married, not having kids. And back in at the time, I was still religious. So we were both of the same religion. And yeah, life was easy. And I would get home from work. We could both check out. We could just order Chinese food and watch movies all night. There's a lot of freedom. And do I miss that? Not really, because I'm older now and I have kids. So I don't know what it would be like to go back to not having kids. So it's just a different phase of life. But no, nothing I would say that I miss about that life. Because if looking back, you look back at old versions of you and you realize that, like right now, I feel like I'm a very self-aware person. Back then, I wasn't aware of who I was or my identity and why I did the things I did or the way I was programmed or deconstructing all of like my programming. And there's a certain amount of bliss that comes from that. And I think with more self-awareness, the downside to that, it comes more responsibility of doing the inner work, which I'm sure we'll get into. Because now you're more responsible of, okay, I recognize my patterns now. I know how to overcome them. I recognize like these triggers and these things that I do that aren't healthy for me or my partner. And now you're responsible for actually consciously choosing to not go down that route. So yeah, there's a certain amount of bliss that comes from being less self-aware. But once you become self-aware, you can't go back. You can't become unaware again. Once you've like gotten out of the matrix, you can't go back in. The same perception. You just can't.
And I know that a lot of that stemmed from your upbringing being so strict in the Mormon religion and the idea that you weren't allowed to express weakness or emotion. So yeah. I know that had some consequences in your life. And you just talked a little bit about when you were a senior, being a partier. So mm-hmm. how did that like strict upbringing then manifest in other behaviors that you were engaging in as you started to get older?
Yeah, this is why going to therapy helps you connect the dots of figuring out, oh, this behavior, this type of mindset led to this, these choices. So looking back on it now, my perception of my religion and that kind of mentality, it really forced me to get really good at wearing masks. And what I mean by that is pretending on the outside, I'm good, I'm perfect, things are fine. But on the inside, struggling, at war with yourself, which leads to self-hate, which leads to self-sabotage, which leads to poor decisions. And I got really good at hiding my weaknesses, even from my wife and from my loved ones, because I was too ashamed of those weaknesses being brought to the surface and people finding out, you know, my inner secrets. So I just learned to suppress and push them away. And what happens is it creates a vicious cycle of shame and guilt, self-hate, self-sabotage. And that's the mindset that I had of just thinking, okay, if I just beat myself up more and hate myself more, that will make me more disciplined and not doing the sinful things that I would do, which led to bad behaviors of hiding things from the people that I love the most. And I really viewed vulnerability as a weakness back then. And I didn't know how to be vulnerable. And I was too afraid and too ashamed to talk about my truth and talk about my weaknesses. So I just felt it was better to hide it from the world. And that comes at a cost of inner conflict and inner war, of looking at yourself through a lens of a failure and someone that doesn't deserve love or isn't worthy of love. And so I developed the mindset of deep down, I'm not good enough. I'm not worthy enough because of all these mistakes, all these sins that I've had that I've covered up and hid from people. And it just, Brené Brown talks a lot about shame, and shame has so much power over you when you don't talk about it. Mm-hmm. But the second you do talk about those shameful things, whether it's to a therapist or a loved one, finally, the less power shame has over you. And the more vocal you are, the easier it gets to like let go of that shame. And for me, it took me hitting my rock bottom and getting found out, going through a divorce, leaving my religion. That rock bottom moment was just a huge identity crisis and totally changed the trajectory of my life, which now I'm grateful for. But at the time was freaking hard to deal with and really hard to go through, because an identity crisis is scary. And taking off your mask and stepping into the arena, we've heard that quote, the man in the arena. Yep. It's like you're standing there naked in front of everyone. It's the most humbling, hard experience of your life but at the same time, it's also very empowering and freeing, I would say, to finally be you and learn how to operate from a place of self-love instead of self-hate. And that's why I'm a huge proponent of teaching people how to love themselves, because I feel like if you operate out of a place of self-love versus self-hate, you'll stop with the self-sabotage. You'll stop with the behaviors that you know aren't good for you. And you'll start wanting to treat yourself and your body with kindness. And that looks like doing hard things. Like, self-love isn't just sitting on the couch and eating ice cream and massage and bubble bath. Self-love looks like doing hard physical things, but also doing hard emotional things. Because that growth comes from doing those hard things. And that's where self-love really shines in motivating you to get up and do the hard things you're supposed to do, because you're worthy of the outcome that those hard things are going to bring into your life. And that's the huge mindset shift that happened for me because I went through that rock bottom moment.
Okay.
We're grateful for that.
Yeah.
That's a lot.
But I want to get into that so people can understand the specifics. But you're bringing something to mind because it seems to me that when you're in a household or a childhood situation where you're taught to repress or forced to repress things rather than express them, it doesn't allow you to confront those hard things you just talked about that are a component of self-love. You have to confront those things in order to have love for yourself. And when you're trying to establish your identity and you have an environment telling you what your identity should be and your inside identity is something else, I think that almost drives people towards risky behavior because they're trying to sort things out. And then that shame comes in when they start to experiment with identities and who they might be. So I know you talk very openly that you started to develop a curiosity about sex and you had explored pornography a bit when you were young.
Yeah.
And that was one of your early sins that you talk about. And so can you just talk a little bit about that part of your life and how that played out in your relationship with your ex-wife?
Yeah, let me paint a picture for those that aren't familiar with the Mormon religion of just that the dynamic of how it works. So sexual sin in the Mormon religion, the way I was raised and my perception of it was, it's a very serious sin. It's a sin next to murder in the seriousness of sins, right? Murder is up there at the top, and right underneath that is sexual sin. So masturbation, sex outside of marriage, all that stuff is thrown in that category. So you grew up with this mentality of like, this is evil, this is bad, don't do it, don't look at pornography. Being a teenage boy growing up in the 90s, where the internet first started coming out, you get exposed to pornography so much more than someone that grew up in the 60s and 70s when there probably wasn't a lot of outlets to access it, except for magazines, if you knew someone. So this was like the perfect storm for a normal teenage boy with raging hormones trying to not look at those things. And so it developed this perspective of myself where I looked at myself as this failure, who I was this disgusting human being who desired to look at naked women but felt so ashamed and so disgusted with myself because I knew it was bad. I knew it was evil. So I didn't know how to separate doing something that was bad or evil from being bad or evil. So I didn't know how to separate that. So I just assumed I was this bad, evil person for looking at it. And of course, there's no one I could go talk to because if you go confess these sins to your Mormon bishop or your the religious leader, there's like a punishment that happens, like where you aren't allowed, for example, to take the bread and water or the sacrament in church. And the bread and water are passed around and everyone gets to see who takes it. And if you don't take it, you're not supposed to take it if you're unworthy. So if you're looking at pornography, you're masturbating, you're doing any kind of sin where you're unworthy, you're not supposed to take the bread and water. So as it comes around, there's all this anxiety of the bishop's going to see me or my family's going to see me as it comes by of if I don't take it, people are going to be, in my mind, I'm so worried about what other people are going to think of me. So you just take it and you feel so much more shame about yourself because you're not supposed to. So anyways, I was like, you know what? This is too much for me. It's like a self-preservation mechanism where it's just, I'm just going to hide it and just not tell anyone. Because the punishment of getting found out was too much for me to handle. So I just pretended like it didn't exist. I just pretended like it didn't happen. And I got really good at it year after year, decade after decade. And then when I was dating my wife at the time, she grew up in the Mormon religion too. And so her perception of pornography was bad, evil too. And so I remember we were dating one time, we were getting pretty serious. We might've been engaged. And she asked if I looked at porn and I admitted to her that I did. And she was devastated. She was heartbroken. She was full of so much fear and disgust with my behavior. She almost called off the wedding. And I, at that moment, was like, oh, I can't tell her this because I'm not safe. If I tell her the wedding's off, we'll get divorced and we won't get the worst case scenario. Of course, I told her, I was like, I will never look at it. Told her all the right things. I was like, I can change. I won't look at it, blah, blah, blah. And of course, it never goes away, right? It doesn't just disappear like by sheer willpower, right? Just like a drug addict, they can try and willpower their way out of a drug addiction, even if they love someone or their kids. But for the most part, most people aren't going to be able to just willpower their way out of an addiction like that. So I just decided to hide it from her. And that led to 2009. I ended up having an affair. And my first reaction was to not tell her. Was to hide it from her. And I had already done that for so long. And the affair thing was so interesting to me because if someone were to ask me, would you ever cheat on your wife? 100%, I would have said no. Never in a million years would I ever imagine I would do something like that. But it's interesting what you're capable of when you believe that you're a failure. Are we allowed to cuss on this show or should we keep PG rated?
Yeah, you can cuss.
I think a fuck up is a better word of how I viewed myself. A failure isn't strong enough. A fuck up is definitely the way I viewed myself, even before the affair. This was just the solidifying that thought of, yes, you are. And I think when you believe you're a failure, you tend to do failure-like things to prove to yourself that you are subconsciously. You don't understand why you do it, but you do it. And this is what self-sabotage is. And this is how dangerous it is. For me, my outlet was porn or like having an affair For other people, it's food or drugs or alcohol or other forms of harm, self-harm. It just looks, it manifests differently for each person. But getting back to my story, of course, I hid it from her. And then about a year later, she ended up finding out from an email and shit hit the fan. It was the most devastating thing for her at the time. And I was obviously disgusted with myself and hated myself, but I wanted to change. I wanted to prove to her that I could change. I didn't want this to be my legacy. And so I was like, I can change, do all the things. We went to therapy. I went to an addiction recovery program, whatever it took to show her that I was dedicated to changing. And we ended up staying together for another 5 years, actually. Obviously, we had kids, and that made it more complicated because we didn't want to break their hearts. They didn't deserve any of this. And yeah, I went through the addiction recovery process. It helped out a little bit. It helped normalize looking at porn for me, because I realized that everyone does. I'm not this weird, disgusting human being that is the only one looking at it. It was normalized for me, and that gave me some hope. It didn't just go away overnight. And it wasn't until I met this life coach in Salt Lake City, Utah. Her name is Catherine Dixon. She saved my life, and I've sent her hundreds of people since then. She uses a method by this author named Byron Katie. She's the author of a book called Loving What Is. And her method, it was so powerful for me in that first session, where I came out of that session realizing that I was lovable despite what I did. I had never had someone in my life, no religious leader, no parent, no person up until that point, convince me that I was lovable. She was the first person to do that. And a light bulb went off in my head of like, oh, maybe I am lovable. And maybe this whole journey of self-sabotage and self-hate has led me down this path of doing these things. Maybe self-love is something that I haven't experienced yet. And it was a very powerful, profound experience where I started to deconstruct my perception of pornography. And at the time, I was also finding out things about my religion that were hidden from me, or the history of the church. A picture was painted for me that just wasn't based on reality or the truth. There was definitely a lot of cover-ups and things hidden about the past and the founder, and things that I used to think were anti-Mormon. Now the church was admitting were actually true. And so that kind of threw me down this rabbit hole. If my religion isn't true that I believed my whole life, what is true? Mm. So leaving my religion, going through a divorce, two huge forms of what my identity was, like completely gone. And I had to start from ground zero. And the one thing that pulled me out of it, because I could have stayed stuck there. And I get why people stay stuck in the victim mindset. Because it's justified. You justify it and it feels justified. And people from an outside perspective are like, yeah, that's justified staying stuck there. I thought I would hate myself for the rest of my life. I would go into hiding. No one would ever talk to me again. And worst case scenario, I was like, I'll just go live in a cave and just disappear from this earth, right? Being a dad and having daughters was the thing that pulled me out of it, helping me realize that they deserve the best version of me, not this broken version, not this person that hates themselves, because I knew I would unconsciously pass on these generational cycles of self-hate and trauma that I would just pass on to them if I didn't do the work on myself of learning how to love myself so that I didn't repeat these old patterns of self-sabotage. And that's where my personal development, learning how to love myself journey started, was from hitting that rock bottom. And so that's where I started seeing this life coach on a regular basis. I started going to therapy, started meditating, started journaling, started doing a gratitude practice, started doing positive affirmations every day. These are just a list of things that have helped me. Started reading books, listening to podcasts that totally changed my perspective. I read a lot of Brené Brown's work. Daring Greatly is another one that popped up that really changed my perspective on guilt and shame, and the religion that I grew up in, and leaving that behind was so healing for me personally. It's not the right path for everyone, but for me, it definitely healed me to let go of all that shame that just had this power over me. And eventually I got to the place where I was able to own my story, like you mentioned, because if you don't own your story, owns you. Yeah. And that's what I learned from Brené Brown, is if I don't own this story, own up to it and tell people what I've learned and how I've arrived at a place of healing from this, then I'm doing a disservice to so many people who are stuck in the same position that I was. And so I went public with my story on my podcast. It was episode 100 of my podcast. And it's the most, to this day, the most downloaded podcast ever. And when I've talked about diet and exercise and weight loss, no one cares about that. They care about why I got divorced, why I had the affair, how it broke me, what I learned from it, how I grew from it, and how did I come to a place of healing and finally learn how to love myself and not define myself by my past. And anyways, it was a very powerful experience to own my story, embrace vulnerability as a strength. And that's why I'm such a huge proponent of these types of things, of owning your story, embracing vulnerability as a strength, and breaking the generational cycles of trauma. There's a good quote that I love, and then I'll stop talking. But it says, if you don't heal what hurts you, you're going to bleed on those who didn't cut you. And this is why it's so important for all of us to do the inner work, because if you don't do the inner work on yourself, you're going to unconsciously pass on those hurtful patterns and programming that you've inherited onto your kids, your grandkids, if you don't break that cycle. And so this is why doing this inner work is so important for me personally, because my daughters deserve a better life than that. They deserve the best version of me physically, mentally, emotionally, and spiritually.
Yeah. Okay. I love everything that you just
said. That was long. That was long,
but it was so good because people need to stop beating themselves up for their past experiences, whether something has happened to you that's caused you shame, or you've done something to someone else that's caused shame in your own life. You need to be able to move through it. And I think that we're given these experiences in some kind of spiritual way to, because we need to learn something. And so do you believe that in order to love yourself, you had to go through those tough things?
Yeah, I do. And then for whatever reason, it had to happen the way it did for me to get to this place of where I am. And this is why I can look back and be grateful for it. Because if you can look at life happening for you versus to you, then you can get out of the victim mentality and arrive at a place of gratitude for what is, instead of fighting what is and saying coulda, woulda, shoulda, accepting it and letting those painful experiences teach you. I love this quote by Rumi. He says, the cure for pain is in the pain. And so many of us as humans, we dislike pain. We hate it. We want to run away from it, escape it, numb ourselves from it, suppress it, push it away. But the pain is there to teach us something. If we don't have pain, if we don't have suffering, we're never going to learn. We're never going to grow. And so this is why it's so important to turn towards the pain. It sucks and it's hard. Don't escape it with food and drugs and alcohol or mindlessly scrolling through social media or whatever self-destructive outlets there are that we have so much access to numbing and desensitizing and just like distracting ourselves from doing the work. It's no wonder why so many of us are stuck in these broken cycles, but yeah, that's why it's so important to just turn towards the pain, let it suck, let it teach you something, and eventually it'll move through you and you'll be free from it. But if you keep suppressing, pushing it down, it's going to keep coming back up until it eventually boils over and it becomes too much. And that's what happened to me, is I kept pushing it away until eventually just spilled out of me and I got found out. And like, I had to like that, it forced me to like change. So that's why I'm grateful for it. And I think adopting that mentality of life happening for you versus to you is a powerful mindset to develop.
Yes, absolutely.
Pardon the interruption, friends, but I had to tell you something. I was recently on a call with Dr. Joe Vitale of The Secret, and he said something to me that will stick with me for the rest of my life. He said, you have to let people know what you're doing, because that's your part in the co-creation process. Letting people know what you're up to helps your people to align with you. So I wanted to give you an update about what's happening in my book club. The Blessins Personal Development Book Club community is growing and people are getting so much out of it. The feedback I've been getting about the takeaways and the tools that people are gathering from our current book, the first book, Mindset by Carol Dweck, it's just feeding my soul. And I know it is my purpose to get the word out about this book club community, because it is literally changing lives. If you love personal development books and you understand the importance of engaging with books actively, doing the work, and interacting in a community of like-minded people around books that have the power to influence your life forever, then join us. because you are just in time for our next book. We will be starting the iconic classic book, Think and Grow Rich by Napoleon Hill on February 20th, 2024. So now is the time to get in so that you can get the book in your hands, find out what you need to do with it, and be ready to dig in before the 20th. So go to mitziecampbell.com/bookclub for more information. And to join, you deserve this. You deserve to do something wonderful for yourself. And it is my pleasure to bring all of the best of my work as a professor into personal development. I think it might be my superpower. Now, back to the show.
I have a spiritual teacher who says that when you heal yourself, you heal 7 generations before you and 7 generations after you.
Yes.
So that's
I believe that. I have a lot of tattoos on my body, but this one, Break the Cycle, is a very important one.
Yeah.
Just as a reminder, hey, you're worth it to do the work. It's not just for you. It's for, our ancestors and for our offspring, like in the future, our kids, our grandkids, and so on, because these patterns can cause a lot of damage if you aren't aware of them. And that's the first step in overcoming this is self-awareness. And
absolutely.
I think that's the first step in starting to change is becoming aware of why you are the way you are and why you do what you do. There's another good quote that I love by Anthony DeMello. He says, what you're aware of, you're in control of. And what you're not aware of is in control of you. And what he means by that is until you become aware of these patterns, you're just going to be running on autopilot. And these patterns are just going to dictate your life for you because you're not even aware of them, of why you're doing what you're doing. You just keep repeating these unhealthy patterns. When you become aware of why you do them, now you can start to control how you respond to them. And that's a whole nother method that I teach people. But anyways, it's super powerful.
Yeah, it's very powerful. And that's why it's so important for you to share your story, because through listening to everyone else tell their stories, we get to know ourselves. That's a huge mechanism for self-discovery, which is one of the main reasons why I love doing this podcast and talking about life stories.
Yeah, I'm grateful that you're letting me share my life story.
We're grateful to have you. You've got a lot to teach and a lot of powerful lessons for people. So I want to talk a little bit about your fit to fat to fit. You actually gained 75 pounds, and people can go online and find the photographs, and lost it within 1 year. That is a whole emotional and physical journey. So can you just tell us what the heck was behind that?
Sure. Yeah. So I was married at the time. This was like 2011 when I came up with this idea. And this was honestly, all this was happening around the time that I was going through the storm of the affair and leaving my religion. All this was happening at the same time. But it just, Fat to Fit was this idea that came from me being a personal trainer, being in shape my entire life, never been overweight once. And I used to think with that black and white mentality, I'm like, it's so easy to be in shape. Because for me, it's easy. All you do is you eat healthy food, you work out really hard, you be disciplined. And it's not that hard. Why do people who are overweight struggle? Why can't they just be disciplined? Why can't they just eat healthy food, put down the junk food, and go to the gym and just do it every day? And what's wrong with people? And I had a client at the time who was my brother-in-law, who was very overweight. And I would see him at family events and he would just be eating all the junk food. I'm like, dude, what are you doing? I'm training you. Like, why are you eating this food? Like, it's not on the plan. He's like, we're at a family event and I want to eat this food. I'm like, yeah, I get so frustrated with him. And one time he told me, you don't understand how hard it is for me or for people like me, because for you, it's always been easy. And that triggered something in me because I couldn't argue with him. I'm like, you're right. I don't understand. I don't understand. And so anyways, it forced me to think of ideas of like, how can I understand better? How can I, understand the struggles? And so for whatever reason, I was driving and this idea of getting fat on purpose popped up in my head. And I instantly felt like it was a calling for me to do. I felt like something different about this idea, right? Sometimes we think of ideas and we're like, oh, this would be a good idea. But this one was like really special. So I was like calling all my friends, calling my family, like, hey, I think I have this idea. What do you guys think? And everyone was like, oh my gosh, that's crazy. You should totally do it. And I was like, the idea was to get fat on purpose, document the journey, and then try and lose it and see what happened. I didn't have any expectations. I didn't have any marketing strategy that was going to like get me the attention that it got me. I just decided to do it. And this is back in 2011. So Facebook was around, YouTube was around, and that's pretty much it. So I just figured it out on my own, started a website, started a YouTube channel, started documenting my journey. People were sharing it, posting about it. I started going on like being interviewed for fitness blogs and like some podcasts at the time. And before we know it, the story went viral. And here we are today.
What was the biggest news outlet that picked that up, or the biggest show at the time?
The Tonight Show with Jay Leno, Good Morning America, Dr. Oz, The View. I don't know which one's the biggest, but those are some pretty big ones.
Yeah. So that kind of propelled you. And then from there, is that when you started your company and really built the empire from there?
Yeah. So a lot of people don't know this, but I was working full time in the medical field. So I left my position as a financial analyst after 2008, 2009, became certified as a personal trainer to make some income while I was trying to find a job. And so I was doing personal training part time. I ended up doing 180 going into the medical industry and had a job working in hospitals. And I did whatever I could and doing part time personal training. And then that's when Fit to Fat to Fit happened. And I was still doing the medical job while I was doing Fit to Fat to Fit. And yeah, it was crazy. So the concept was for 6 months, no exercise, couldn't exercise at all. And I wanted to focus on everyday American foods, like heavily processed foods that are cheap and affordable, very convenient, and they taste freaking good. And so I ate a lot of cinnamon toast crunch, a lot of white bread, white pasta, juices, granola bars, chips, cookies, crackers, sugary sodas, like all these foods that we have here in America that are, you know, they taste freaking good. I'm not going to lie. They're designed to be hyper palatable and they're designed to be as addictive as possible. And they're super cheap and affordable compared to real whole healthy food. Yep. And they're just so convenient. And so it's no wonder 80% of our population gets addicted to this food because it's cheaper than whole food. It's more convenient and it tastes way better. You can't beat the taste of cinnamon toast crunch. You can't find that in nature. So I get why people get stuck in these vicious cycles of eating this food. And from a chemical perspective in the brain, the dopamine that's released is just like any other drug or any other high dopamine substance or activity. It feels good. It feels like if you're going through painful stuff in your life, finances, relationship, breakups, whatever it is, it's easy to escape through food because food is legal. You can order whenever you want to. There's DoorDash, there's Uber Eats, there's gas stations, there's grocery stores. Like we have an abundance of food here in this country. And this food is so cheap and affordable and so convenient and it's so freaking tasty. You could get the dopamine hit multiple times per day and just eat your feelings away. You eat your emotions and you suppress those negative emotions. And I have so much empathy now for why people get stuck in the vicious cycle of emotional eating and self-sabotage through food. Like I understand it on such a deeper level now, having done Fit to Fat to Fit twice. It's really opened up my eyes to empathize with people that have food addictions, just like people have drug addictions. We all escape through different mechanisms or substances. And I don't judge people for what substance they choose to use or they grew up with or just got presented to them. But it's the same type of mechanism. And if you read Dr. Gabor Mate's work, he says behind every addiction is some type of pain. Mm-hmm. Any addiction is don't ask why the addiction, ask why the pain. What's this person trying to escape from? What's the pain they're trying to run away from and suppress? Mm-hmm. And then you'll get at the root cause of the addiction. It's not the drug that's the problem. It's the pain that they're trying to cover up or escape from. And a lot of it is trauma and abuse and really hard things that, you know, humans have to deal with in this life. So
do you think that a part of that journey was beyond wanting to connect to empathy with your clients, something about you? Do you think it was some type of punishment or something you were working through?
Kind of. At the time, I wasn't really aware of the connection between the physical journey of Fit to Fat to Fit and how emotionally, like where I was going in my life of self-discovery and being humbled and developing empathy. Because I would say I was a pretty nice guy growing up, pretty understanding. I wouldn't say I was empathetic towards people. I was more judgmental back then. But being humbled through that experience definitely helped me develop empathy. And it led me down this path of self-discovery, personal development, self-love, self-awareness, and all of that bled into how I coached people or how I showed up for people and how I listen to people and their stories of making them feel seen and heard and understood, because I wanted to feel seen and heard and understood too, just like every human does. And there is medicine in giving that to someone and helping someone feel seen, heard, and understood. There's a good quote I love by Teddy Roosevelt. He says, "With no one cares how much you know until they know how much you care." And that is really what Fit to Fed to Fit is. That's our mantra, is you could have all the accolades in the world and have all the knowledge as a scientist to understand the human body and how to manipulate body composition and lose fat and use this amount of macros and calories and workouts to get your body to look a certain way. But humans are emotional creatures, and no one cares if you have all the knowledge in the world of how to fix their body. I think most people want to feel seen. They want to feel understood. So they want to know that you care about them. And that's how I've been able to show up differently because of that experience. And so, yeah, Fit to Fed to Fit really has bled over into this personal journey of that I've gone through that has helped save me. And now I can have more tools available at my disposal to help people versus, hey, do this diet or hey, do this workout. And then it'll make all your problems go away once you get this body. For me, that's not how it works, in my opinion. That's not, if that was how it worked, then everyone would just be like, oh, we'll eat less food and we'll work out and we'll get in shape and we'll be happier. But that doesn't happen.
So. No, it's not that easy. But it is interesting how all of that was happening at the same time for you, and it was all a part of your self-love and love for others all happening at the same time. Like, it was all about love, the whole, everything going on in your life at that time, about learning to love. Yep. And so that is really interesting. When you were heavy at your, in your experiment, did you question your self-worth more, and did you find that people were judging you at all?
So the first time, yes, because the first time was my first experience being overweight. And that was a huge identity crisis for me. I honestly freaked out a little bit because I had created this identity of Drew the fit guy in my mind. And that's how I viewed myself. That was the lens I looked through of how I viewed myself, of how the world viewed me. So being 20 pounds overweight was super uncomfortable for me, where I felt like I had to go up to strangers. I wanted to. And explain to them, like, hey, I'm not really this overweight person. Normally, like, I look like this, and here's this website. I'm doing this experiment. You don't know me, but I just felt like I had to come tell you that I'm normally an in-shape guy. But because it was so uncomfortable for me to be overweight. So the first time, I wasn't doing a lot of work on myself, inner work, the first time around. And it caused a huge identity crisis. And I was more self-conscious. I didn't take my shirt off in public when I was overweight. And yeah, it definitely developed this insecurity where I didn't feel valuable being overweight. I didn't feel any kind of self-worth or self-love because I valued my body looking a certain way, because this modern society places value on that. And if you look a certain way, you're respected by your peers, and it feels good to be respected by your peers. It wasn't until 2020 when I had a lot more tools at my disposal, a lot more self-love and self-awareness at that time, that being overweight didn't bother me at all. I totally rocked the dad bod, didn't care about taking my shirt off. I owned my body because I realized my body is temporary. My body can change. My body isn't stuck. It's always just constantly changing, and it can be fit, it can be fat, it can be skinny, it can be old, wrinkly, it can be all the things. It can change. And so your body isn't your identity. Your body image should not be your self-image. But so many of us do that. And it's a disservice, I think, because at some point in time, you're going to have an identity crisis, whether you get older and you have wrinkles and your body isn't what it looked like when you're 20. And so letting go of that at some point in time is going to be super valuable for you, because otherwise you're going to have an identity crisis like I had. But it might not be till later on in life. But learning how to disconnect your body image from your self-image was a huge learning point for me. But I wouldn't say I was like sad or depressed being overweight. I just didn't like it. Obviously, the way I looked was one thing, but how I felt was just 10 times worse, because you're sleep deprived. You're not sleeping through the night. Your hormones are all over the place. You're emotional. You're more reactive. Your cortisol is elevated. My testosterone levels dropped. Your libido drops. Your sex life, your circulation, all the things, just your body is not what it used to be when you're overweight. And I think that's one thing that helped me empathize with people who are overweight. It's not fun to be in a body that can't do all the things that everyone else can do, to be honest with you. Mm-hmm. And it would suck to be stuck in that body. And I have a lot of empathy for the people who are in larger bodies and don't like being there, because it's not as simple as just eating less and working out to get out of it. It's not just, like, hey, just go discipline yourself and get this new body and you'll be happy. A lot of that trauma, I would say, stems from trauma that's been put on that person's inherited. And that's just a self-preservation mechanism of being in control and using food as safety and comfort and control. And it's not as simple as just, okay, I'm going to stop it now. It's years and decades of programming. And that's where I try and help people deconstruct that.
Yeah. Because it's more than just about the food at that point. It's so many different processes happening in the body, and the body is a whole system. And then there's the chemical addiction to the things that are put into processed foods and things like this. It's a lot more complex than it looks, right? Interesting. Yeah. I can relate to that. For health reasons, I have changed my diet and gone pretty extreme with my diet. And I only eat basically meat, vegetables, and fruit right now. And no gluten, no dairy. And I started to lose weight, and I'm not a big person. So I actually started to get scared that I was losing too much weight. And it is like the way that your body responds to food and the things that you're putting into it is really interesting. It's interesting you mentioned that, how it affected your emotions and how it affected the processes of your body, your hormones and everything. Yes. Like, it's tied to everything. People really don't think of it that deeply. They just think, oh, I want to lose weight.
Yeah. When I did my second journey in 2020, it really opened up my eyes to how much of our emotional and mental well-being is tied to our food, our activity levels or lack thereof, and how much it's affected by all of that, by a sedentary lifestyle. And people don't connect those dots. They think, oh, if I eat this food, I'll lose weight. If I eat this food, I'll gain weight. But it does so much more to you than just that. Like, food is information for our bodies. And if you're eating a lot of highly processed junk food and your emotions are tied to that food, even if you don't gain a lot of weight, even if you don't have a lot of fat on your body, you're still doing yourself a disservice in the long run because of your health. Like, there's in my industry, a lot of people don't look at it this way, but there's weight loss and there's health. And those two aren't always the same thing. Mm-hmm. Just because you're losing weight, just because you're skinny, doesn't mean you're necessarily healthy. And this is why it's so important to do things like blood work and get other tests done. You don't just rely on the scale to figure out, okay, where is your health at? Especially me being in my 40s, as people get older, like you have kids, like you have grandkids, you want to be around, you want to be able to play with them. You want to be able to do the things. And it's not about your weight. It's not about like just losing weight. It's about changing your habits, your systems in life to provide you with good physical health and realizing and believing that you are worthy of good physical health and that self-love doesn't need to always be eating cake and ice cream. Self-love can also look like eating the chicken and broccoli on a consistent basis because you know that food is healthier for you because you are going to have better digestion. You are going to have better energy. You are going to sleep better and have better sex and have better skin and all the things that come with feeding your body real whole foods. You start to realize, oh, I'm worthy of that. And you don't look at it through the lens of, oh, this is a chore. I have to diet. I have to exercise. Like, it's so hard. Yes, it is hard to do those things in the short term, but it brings long-term fulfillment, just like any other kind of discipline in life will do. And I think that's what needs to happen for a lot of people is their perception of the process of health and fitness needs to change. And as you fall in love with yourself and you develop self-love, you start to fall in love with the process of doing the hard things that you know you're supposed to do. But those hard things don't feel like a chore anymore because you're doing it from a place of worthiness and self-love. Hey, I deserve this. Like, you deserve this. You're worthy of this. And when you start to look at it through that lens, then you can show up for yourself and treat your body with kindness by eating the chicken and broccoli. And yeah, sure, every once in a while, having the cake and ice cream too, when it's appropriate. But if you're sad one day and you eat your emotions, or it's a Friday and you're celebrating your emotions, there's a million excuses to go eat that food, but it comes at a cost, right? It does come at a cost of our health. If you're more consistently eating the junk food, it's going to come at the cost of your health. And at some point it's going to catch up to you. I think it really does come. It's deeper than just wanting to look a certain way. And maybe you use that to start out. Maybe you're like, hey, I want to jumpstart my health journey and I want to lose a bunch of weight, and maybe wanting to look good is like what gets you started. But if you want it to last for your entire life, you want it to be a lifestyle change, it has to come from a place of self-acceptance and self-love if you want it to be lasting, fulfilling change. Otherwise, it's just going to be something you do for a short period of time, and then you go back to your old programming.
Yeah, it's all about the programming. We've normalized so many unhealthy lifestyle things that changing your lifestyle is so hard. So we just don't think of healthy behaviors as normal behaviors. We think of drive-through McDonald's and that kind of thing as just normal part of everyday life. And it's really a shame. It's really a shame. But I love what you said about identity and self-love. And I just want to talk about that for a second. I want people to understand, though, that like self-love and identity, there's nothing wrong with wanting to be fit, wanting to look good, wanting to have certain characteristics. There's self-love and acceptance, but there's also, it's okay to improve and be better. What do you think about that?
Yeah, there has to be the duality of both of those things. And it's like the yin and yang of life. We don't have to live in these extremes of either you're going to be sedentary and not move, or you're going to be this extreme fitness freak, right? I think making progress, and this is kind of like the whole concept of self-love, of the duality of it. There's both sides of it. Yes, there is a time and place for Netflix and chill, ice cream, chocolate, like cake. Like there's a time and place for that. And I think that can be implemented into a self-love type of lifestyle. Cause I eat those foods and I eat those foods with my girls sometimes. And we don't eat a strict paleo diet all the time. Like I'm okay with them eating those foods, but also realizing that self-love is also making progress, mm-hmm. and that progressing, there's nothing wrong. You can love yourself as you are, as even if you're unhealthy and your body's overweight, I think it's possible to love yourself and you as you are, and also want to improve your situation. That doesn't mean you don't love yourself completely. It doesn't mean you don't believe that you're unworthy. You are worthy. You are lovable. You are enough. And also you're worthy to keep going. And it feels good to keep going, because if you don't progress in this life, every human needs some type of progress. If you stay stagnant, you'll get depressed if you're not moving forward in some way, shape or form, physically, mentally, emotionally, spiritually, financially, in some form, you have to be moving forward. And that's a form of self-love. And I think there just needs to be balance. The problem is we live in such a society of convenience and comfort that it's literally killing us. We have way too many comforts available, and we're biologically wired to seek comfort. And so this is why it's so hard for so many humans to make progress, is because we suck at getting uncomfortable. Being uncomfortable in our time and age is like going outside in non-air-conditioned air for 15 minutes and like having the heat on you. That's uncomfortable for a lot of people because we have so many comforts at our disposal. Yeah. And as humans, like we just have developed all these comforts over the years. And that's amazing with technology, but it's literally killing us. Where to do something hard, like meditate for 10 minutes, or to do a cold shower for 3 minutes, or to skip a meal, or to go hungry, or go to sleep on time, like these discipline type things are that's too hard. That's too uncomfortable for me. So this is what happens. If you want change, if you want transformation, you have to train your brain to start getting comfortable being uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. So that's why I'm a huge proponent of things like making your bed every single morning, or taking a cold shower every single day. Or another challenge that I have people do if they hate meditating is to do a sit still challenge, where they have to sit in a seated position, spine straight, and not move a muscle. They can't blink an eye. They can't scratch an itch. They can't adjust their muscles. Literally just try and sit still and see if you can do it for 5 minutes. And a lot of adults suck at this. A lot of kids too, probably. But just being able to sit still and being disciplined and sitting still and being the master of your body. Meditation is another form of discomfort. Exercise is a discomfort. Meal prepping is a discomfort. Like all these things that are uncomfortable are what is required to give us the change that we're seeking. There's no pill we can just take to like skip past all of that. And you got to do the hard work. So if you want change in your life, at some point you're going to have to start doing uncomfortable things. Mm-hmm. And that's why training your brain to get comfortable being uncomfortable is the first step to making that change, to be like, all right, I can do hard things. I can do this hard thing. If I can take a cold shower and I can journal and I can do positive affirmations and I can go to a therapist, I can get myself to do a 10-minute walk today, or be disciplined to eat the chicken and broccoli instead of the cake and ice cream, right? Little things like that. And then you add them up over time and you see how much progress you've made. And you're fighting against the system, if you will, because like I said, we're biologically wired to seek comfort. And we live in a world of like too many comforts.
It seems like some of those things people might perceive as hard, but really they're just different. It's just a different kind of lifestyle, something they have to do differently. And that itself can be uncomfortable sometimes, right? Because people don't like change.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh my gosh.
Yes. And the fear of the unknown too.
Yeah. The fear of the unknown. So what would you say are the biggest lessons that you've learned over this big journey of yours?
Yeah, a few. I would say transformation is way more mental and emotional than people think. A lot of people think it's calories and macros and this diet and this workout. And if you do, that's not the key to transformation, in my opinion. It's more so overcoming your mental and emotional hurdles and becoming aware of what those hurdles are and where they stem from in the first place. That's the real battle. So I tell people working in is just as important, if not more important, than working out. So you have to do both. Like, you can go and do a hardcore workout program, but if you want to overcome these patterns that have kept you back your whole life, you have to do the inner work too. So the inner work is, like I mentioned, going to therapy, life coaching, journaling, getting out in nature, exercising, eating healthy foods, sleeping, managing your stress. So breath work and meditation are really good tools for helping people manage their stress. And then also emotional eating, like the emotional connection to food is way more powerful than we think it is. And I have so much empathy for those that struggle with food addiction. Seeking professional help or understanding your addictions. There's a really good book that I love called Willpower Doesn't Work by Benjamin Hardy. Really good book about not just relying on your willpower to get yourself out of the situation, but changing your environment. And there's a lot of good strategies in there to change your environment. And as you adapt to that new environment, change becomes a byproduct of adapting to that new environment. And so you're not relying on your willpower muscle, you're relying on your human capabilities to just adapt to a new environment.
Right.
Just like you see when people go on The Biggest Loser, right? They go to this new environment, they have these amazing results because they're put into a completely new environment. Yep. But what happens when they go back to their old environment? 95% of them or more gain the weight back because now they go straight back to their old environment, right? So changing up your environment is a really powerful tool. That's a good book. And then let's see what else. Yeah, I think operating out of a place of self-love versus self-hate gets you out of that self-sabotage cycle and not beating yourself up over your old patterns. And as you try and change yourself and develop this new identity, just having compassion. Because what I've learned is that there's these parts of us that have been created to preserve ourselves, right? It's a self-preservation tool that our minds create to save us maybe from destroying ourselves. And so at one point in time, maybe food became this mechanism to escape the pain and lessen the pain so that you survived. But now that you're older and you don't need that survival mechanism anymore, it's about learning to let those parts of you go and think, not hate those parts. Like, a lot of people like hate those parts and they wish those parts were never there. But they were there to serve you at one point in time, whether it was food addiction or drug addiction or whatever the addiction was, it was there as a self-preservation mechanism. So if you look back on those old versions of you and have compassion for those old versions of you, I feel like you can separate yourself from those old parts. If you can't do it with hate, can't just hate yourself to separate from those parts, but you can only transform it with love and giving those old parts, those old versions of you love. And realizing that you were doing the best you could at the time. And now it's okay to let go of these parts and saying, I don't need you anymore, and being able to move forward without those parts. They're still going to come up. You're human. They're still going to be there. But just becoming aware of them is super important in being able to move forward and separate yourself from those old parts as not your identity anymore, but just a part of you that existed at one point in time to serve you. And now you're creating a new identity without those old parts. And that takes time. So those are probably the major lessons that I've learned from Fit to Fat to Fit.
Yeah, that's beautiful. I heard something the other day that really resonated. It's something along the lines of, it's a good thing you can't erase a piece of your past because you would be erasing a part of yourself. And you need all of the parts of yourself in order to be the person you are today. You know, I love that. Yeah. What about your blessings? What are you most grateful for?
To I'm grateful for being a dad. Like, I'm grateful for my ex-wife and having kids. And that has given me a sense of purpose that I think has driven me to the path that I'm on. I'm grateful for all the past mistakes that I made. Mm. I'm grateful for the people in my life that have molded me and shaped me in a certain way, whether it's old coaches, whether it's my parents, whether it's my siblings, friends that have come into my life, old relationships, even exes. I'm grateful for ex-girlfriends, because they've all been a learning lesson for me. They've all been an opportunity for growth, in my opinion. And so even though things didn't work out with all of them, I've definitely learned a lot from them. And so I'm grateful for all of them. I'm grateful for experiences. Like, experiences really do shape our beliefs. And you have to realize that your experiences have shaped your beliefs. And you also have to believe other people that their experiences have shaped their beliefs, just like yours have confirmed your beliefs. And I think that can give you a lot of empathy for why people believe in the things that they do, instead of, well, what's wrong with this person? Why do they believe that? If you get curious about them, ask them and get to know why they are the way they are, it's a powerful tool for empathy. There's a really good book, last book. It's called What Happened to You by Oprah and Dr. Bruce Perry, I think his name is.
Okay.
And it goes into the science of why people are the way they are because of past experiences and how it's molded their brain to show up a certain way. Instead of saying, what's wrong with you? What happened to you?
Yeah.
And that gives you a different perspective.
Okay. That's really great. You've given us so much to think about. I love all the quotes and the book recommendations. Thank you so much for being here and for sharing your story so vulnerably. I think this is going to have so much to teach people. And we just want to continue to watch you on your journey. And so where can people find you?
Yeah, right now you can find me at fittofattofit.com with the number 2 in between. That's also my handle for all my social medias, fit2fat2fit. So Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, Twitter, YouTube, all the things. And that's, for right now, that's probably the best place to find me.
Okay, that sounds great. Thank you, Drew. Thanks for joining me.
Yeah.
And I hope you have a great, great night.
If you've gotten to the end of this episode, I know that you are one of my loyal listeners, and you probably already know this, but the impact of other people's stories in our lives is profound and powerful. And I want to read you some feedback that I got from Dash, whose story I shared at the beginning of season 2. He received this note and he shared it with me. Hi, Dash. We met years ago in Santa Fe when you treated me to a wonderful lunch. I just finished listening to your interview on Blessings, and I had to reach out. My mixed feelings right now include inspiration, joy, and a deep gratitude to you for sharing your incredible life and its lessons. I also feel a sadness that I did not get to know you better when I was in Santa Fe. You embody grace and a loving humor that I imagine enfolds everyone you meet. And boy, what an exciting life. I'm actually getting choked up reading that, because when I get feedback like this, it's hard for me to even describe the feelings that come up. It's a mixture of happiness, pride, and tremendous gratitude. It keeps me going. But most of all, it reminds me that I am putting something meaningful out there into the world, something that the world needs. So thank you to all of my listeners and to all of the people who have blessed me with their stories. I know that I'm doing the right thing. Thank you for keeping me on track.